KALW. From KALW News in San Francisco, this is Cross Currents. Context, culture, and connection from around the Bay Area.
Pinole, California.
Santa Clara.
I'm from Fremont.
Pacifica, California.
Pleasanton.
Coming up, why some kids do better in school inside juvenile hall.
They're sleeping, and they're sober, and they're on a routine, and it's horrifying that they need to be incarcerated to have that experience.
Then it's tax day, and we're going to find out how filing works in another country.
For an Estonian, even talking about tax filing in the US, trying to understand the system, it is too much effort.
And a prisoner has an unconventional idea for stopping crime.
If I had a prescription for marijuana, they will not worry about me coming back up here.
A story from Solano State Prison and more today on Cross Currents. Tens of thousands of young people in California are in juvenile hall. And to get their education, they have schools inside. Those schools are called court schools. And as the number of incarcerated youth in the state continues to decline, class sizes inside these court schools are smaller than they've been in years. That means more teachers in those schools can provide personal attention for some of the state's most at-risk students. But what does education inside a court school look like, and what happens once students are released? In 2017, KALW's justice reporter Holly J. McDeed explored that question for the next story. And a note to our listeners, we've changed the names of all the incarcerated young people in this piece to protect their identities.
High school dropout or not, even inside San Francisco's juvenile hall, kids still have to go to class at a place called Woodside Learning Center.
Just wanted to say good afternoon to you all. What we're going to do today, good afternoon.
Woodside Learning Center looks just like, well, a school. Desks, students, teachers, the whole shebang. The only difference is students at Woodside have been arrested. Classrooms aren't grouped by grade level, and most students only stay for 2 days. So teachers like Megan Mercurio give lessons students can jump right into, like this poetry workshop.
So who would like to go next?
Mike walks to the front of the classroom and starts reading.
I am from the fire pit, where being sober is no use, no hope. I am from a family of thieves and junkies when no dad's around.
A probation officer stands in the back, listening in. Around 10 other students sit at attention in green sweatshirts and khakis. Mike describes the trauma many kids in custody can relate to.
I'm from abandoned buildings because I was abandoned. Because the devil came from heaven and I came from hell. So I pray St. Peter lets me in and frees me from this cell.
This class size is small, but there's still three teachers in the room. One ESL instructor, one special needs teacher, and one English teacher. San Francisco Court School Director Elise Castro says class sizes here have been dropping for years. On a typical day, there might be 40 students in the entire school. 10 years ago, that number was more like 140.
It's really nice to be working in this line of work during the time when California and the United States is really rethinking our obsession with locking people in little boxes.
But the big challenge for teachers here, she says, is reaching kids in the little time they have. Most students arrive in juvenile hall in crisis mode.
I mean, there's so much on their minds that sometimes, you know, science and math can't percolate up to the surface, but sometimes they also can be the perfect refuge.
Amy knows that feeling. She was first arrested when she was 13.
I thought I was gonna just die young, you know, because of the people around me. And you could be talking to me, and I just be like, but I'll be going out the other ear. Trust me, I did not care.
When her boyfriend was shot and killed, she wanted to turn her life around, and so she started caring more about school. And here at Woodside, she says, success feels more obtainable than it does in public schools.
Now I actually love it. And I sit in the front now and I try to learn everything. And if I don't understand, I'd be like, what is that? And sometimes they get, not annoying, but, you know, they have to explain it. But they still explain it to me, you know.
Court school director Elise Castro says it's common for some students to actually do better in school once they're locked up.
because they're sleeping and they're sober and they're on a schedule and they're on a routine and they're dealing with adults who are treating them respectfully and warmly and lovingly. And it's horrifying that they need to be incarcerated to have that experience.
The thing is, though, Castro says, there's not a lot of data out there to indicate whether or not court schools are working. Stanford education professor Bill Kosky says that's a big barrier to reform.
We could start with the baseline, our kids going to school, you know, our kids getting reconnected with their education in some way, shape, or form. There's a lot of different measures, and the thing is, we know almost nothing about that.
The tools used to measure the success of traditional schools, Kosky says, just don't hold up with court schools. For instance, a recent report from Youth Law Center says 35% of students at Woodside Learning Center end up dropping out of high school, which is much higher than the statewide dropout rate of around 11%. But that data is designed to track kids over a four-year period. Students at Woodside usually only stay in juvenile hall for a few days.
It also requires the attention of policymakers to make this a priority, to say, you need to collect these data. We need to figure out what's happening with these kids and what goes on in those schools.
One promising step. School districts across the state have recently started hiring transition specialists to keep tabs on kids after their release from juvenile hall.
And I think we're trying to really find out, you know, in general, what works, what students need. Is it just, you know, a warm body who they recognize looking out for them? Is it making sure that the new school is prepared? Is it, you know, what is it?
Sam Janeway became San Francisco's first transition specialist this fall. He's kind of like an educational caseworker. He helps kids in juvenile hall enroll in school after they're released. He says one of the challenges is that school administrators can be hesitant to take in recently incarcerated kids. His job is to help change that mindset.
There's schools that don't want these kids, and they feel like, you know, the student is potentially infecting the school or, you know, whatever. And so I make a big deal out of the student, and I'm like, this is an important kid, and this is a kid that can be successful with support.
Right now, he's working to help around 30 formerly incarcerated young people stay in school. Amy is one of them. She was released a few months ago.
I don't know. It's like, I was kind of nervous because I was scared, like, if I'm going to fail again.
But she had her own transition specialist to help her this time. Janeway helped her enroll in downtown high school and still checks up on her.
I'm trying to take advantage, full advantage, because there's places that do not have nothing like this, that doesn't have people like Sam, this level of help.
Amy is expecting to graduate high school next spring, but other students Janeway is working with are struggling.
I don't look at the challenges very often, even when, you know, a student gets taken back into custody, because I think, well, there'll be another chance, you know, to try to do it right for that student. So,
for Janeway and other transition specialists, balancing hard work and advocacy with that kind of realism that some of these kids will be back in trouble soon is a constant challenge.
Okay, you're gonna do cabbage?
Back at Woodside Learning Center, students are digging into dirt, planting their own seeds. Darren has been here long enough to watch the seeds he planted grow into a garden. And that might be a bigger problem. He's been cycling in and out of custody for years now.
They trap you, we come in here for crimes we commit. And then they expect us just to come in here and get these programs and change our life around. But it's like, once we leave here, we're going back to the same thing. We left to.
For now, he says, his teachers do the best they can with the resources they have. And once Darren is released, there's at least one person whose job is to try to help him figure out what happens next. In San Francisco, for Cross Currents, I'm Holly J. McTeed.
Holly J. McDeed is KLW's justice reporter. You can reach her at justice@klw.org. And an update, San Francisco supervisors are proposing to shut down the city's juvenile hall by 2021. You're listening to Cross Currents from KALW News. I'm Hannah Baba. Our news department had a visiting journalist a couple of years ago. His name was Jürgen Klemm, a professional broadcaster from Estonia in northeastern Europe. So we used to ask Jürgen all these questions about his impression of the Bay Area, of California, and of the U.S. Now, when tax time came around, we had to ask, how do Estonians file their taxes, and how does the U.S. system compare? He started off by telling us about this email reminder he got saying it was almost time to file his U.S. tax return.
A couple of weeks ago, I received an email reminding me that it would soon be time to file my U.S. tax return for the year 2016. The email said that first and foremost, I do have to locate my W-2 form showing my earnings and taxes for last year. Secondly, if I decided to use tax service, I would have to find a reputable company that is aware of the specific conditions concerning my visa and the specific laws of the state of California. But if I decided to file my own taxes, I would need to find the 1040NREZ form on the IRS webpage. For an Estonian, even talking about tax filing in the US, trying to understand the system, it is too much effort. This story has, up to this point, used about 1 minute of airtime. And this is approximately how long it took me to file my Estonian tax return. About 1 minute. Let me walk you through the process. I have to log into my bank account, where I will find my tax return form, which has already been filled in for me. There I see my annual income, the taxes I paid, and the amount of over or underpaid taxes. Then I click one button to confirm that all of the information is correct and I agree to it. And that's about it. 1 minute. Just think about it for a second. All of the information required for tax forms already exists in digital databases. So in my case, my Estonian employer has stated my annual salary and my income tax can be very easily calculated by that. My doctor and hence our digitized healthcare system knows exactly how many days I was sick and how much sick leave I've received. And my bank account states my exact income, so there is really no reason for me to duplicate this information and fill it in on paper. In the Estonian case, the Tax and Customs Board pre-fills the tax forms based on the information they already have. So they're not asking me to prove I have paid the right amount of tax. Rather, they're asking me to make sure it taxed me correctly. How is it possible that the Estonians can enjoy this luxury of filing their taxes in 1 minute with a single mouse click? A very important aspect to keep in mind is the minuscule size of my country, especially as compared to the United States. For us, tax reform is much easier. As an example, imagine changing direction in a kayak. You can do a full turn within seconds without moving any distance. But this is not the case if you want to turn around an oil tanker. The small size of my country also means that we simply can't afford complicated systems. Using our people for the things that computers can do is a luxury we are not able to indulge. Maybe you have heard about a small Estonian company called Starship Technologies that's testing small delivery robots from Redwood City, California to Washington, D.C. The idea springs directly from the fact that it's too costly to use people to do the same job. And surely you have heard about this idea to connect San Francisco and LA with Hyperloop trains, which would enable travel by rail at speeds faster than airlines. This is something a lot of people think of as an utopian fantasy. Well, for us, building a Hyperloop train under the Baltic Sea is probably the most efficient and reasonable way to connect to our neighboring capitals. For us, this is very real. But this is a different kind of reality, the underdog reality, because we, as underdogs, cannot afford to take the ineffective way.
Jürgen Klemm is a broadcaster from Estonia who was a visiting journalist at KLW in 2017. This is Cross Currents. I'm Hannah Baba. Next up, we've got a story from Uncuffed, our series recorded and edited by men at Solano State Prison in Vacaville.
This is Uncuffed.
Stories from Solano State Prison.
A lot of people are in prison for crimes related to marijuana, but some believe that cannabis could have kept them away from crime and out of prison. Uncuffed producer Brian Thames speaks to one of those people.
The California Department of Corrections and Rehabilitation offers prisoners an opportunity to curb and eliminate some of their addictive behaviors through a substance abuse program, or SAP. Perry Adams has volunteered to be in the program, but he also feels that this particular substance could help, not hurt, his ability to be a productive citizen.
What's your name, young man?
My name is Perry Adams.
Is that what people call you?
They call me T.I.
They call you T.I.?
Yeah. All right.
So where did you and I meet?
We met in a substance abuse group. I am in it because I have a substance issue.
Substance, such as?
Marijuana. I started off with BDs at like 7 or 8.
Well, tell me what that is.
BD is like a leafy type, like some sort of a cigarette.
Kind
of
like a clove cigarette?
Like a clove cigarette,
okay,
yeah.
So they were real strong.
They was. They were thin. They looked like joints. And I used to steal them from my cousin when I was about 7 or 8 years old and creep around the side and smoke them. We smoke grass.
Actual grass? You mean like on your lawn?
Dried up grass.
Okay.
We would go find a dried up grass. I smoked just pure paper. I did anything because cigarettes, anything where I could practice smoking. I wanted to smoke. I don't know what it was about me and smoking.
You were 11 years old when you first smoked weed, right?
I was 11 years old. I was in the sixth grade. And I was one of the, you know, more challenged kids in my behavior. I hung out with a group of Latino kids that were just as bad as me. And we smoked pot. I didn't have my own joint because I had never smoked it, right? But I was hanging out with the kids and they already had the joints already, you know, twisted up. And it was an average size joint. Initially, I didn't know. I wasn't feeling anything because I really didn't know how to smoke. And then my Latino friend told me, you know, you got to hit it. You got to, you know, take some air into your lungs so that the smoke sat up in your lungs and then blew it out.
Yeah, you said that you were a quote-unquote badass. Tell me what that means.
I was a horrible kid. I terrorized the school. I terrorized the neighbors, my friends. I ain't had no friends after so long. I say about the eighth grade, I was out of friends. I fought them all. Once I discovered weed, it kind of mellowed me out. It prevented me from doing a lot of stupid things that I would have done had I not been high.
How can you be so certain of that?
The only thing that can prevent me from my temper from going 0 to 100 was I was high.
Have you ever had a job? Have you held a legitimate job?
Absolutely.
While smoking weed?
I started off as a racker, but I worked on a 7-inch press machine. I fabricated aluminum. You have to have complete focus. Or else that metal, it'll jump off that conveyor belt, burn you, burn the machine operator. There's no way that if I could not function high, that I can do my job properly.
So were you high some of the time, that job in particular, or all the time?
I got up,
I got ready for work. On my way to work, I got high.
Have you been to prison before this time,
no? No, sir.
This is your first time?
Yeah.
What were you convicted of?
I was convicted of robbery, kidnapped for the purpose of robbery, assault with a firearm on a person, and I had an enhancement of 10 years for use of a firearm in the commission of a crime, and I had a GBI enhancement, which is a great bodily injury upon a person.
Why did you do that?
It had been a few days, man. I had been sober as a joker.
Are you suggesting that that had anything at all to do with what you did?
Absolutely. If I'd been high, I probably wouldn't have did it. So I'm not really one of those people that get high and then go out. I need to be somewhere where I'm comfortable, where I can either pass out or eat up every day.
You're not high right now, right?
Absolutely not.
Okay. There's something I want to fast forward to. What do you think about the idea of mandating that certain parolees smoke weed in order to curb their violent tendencies or their anxiety?
That would be the best decision that the state of California decides.
Why?
Because it will prevent a lot of reoffenders.
Why do you think that you're qualified to say that?
I'm not, but I can speak from my own experience. If I had a prescription for marijuana, they would not worry about me coming back up here. Period.
That was Perry Adams talking to Brian Thames. Brian is a producer in KALW's radio program at Solano State Prison, which is supported by the California Arts Council and the Department of Corrections and Rehabilitation. The producers fact-check content to the best of their ability. All content is approved by an information officer. You can listen to more stories from Uncuffed at our website, kalw.org/uncuffed. And don't forget to subscribe to the Cross Currents podcast. You can hear more from Uncuffed and also all our stories and interviews whenever you want. Music is by The Yellow Dress from San Francisco. They're performing at the Golden Bull in Oakland tomorrow night. And I will take each moment carefully, leaving only what you need from me. And I will try my best to always see with a Today's Cross Currents team includes Janae Darden, Lance Gardner, True Gwynn, Marissa Ortega-Welch, Jessica Plachik, Porfirio Rangel, Marco Seiler Gonzalez, Andrew Stelzer, and Eli Wirtschafter. Our engineers are James Rollins, Tariq Foda, and Gabe Graben. Content manager is Shirin Adil. Our managing editor is David Boyer. Deputy news director is Angela Johnston. News director is Ben Trefney. Our opening theme music is by the John Santos Quintet. For Cross Currents, I'm Hannah Baba.